This episode discusses disordered eating. Please take care while listening.
I walked into my first treatment center for eating disorders when I was 17 or 18. I'd been struggling with food and body image since I was about 8, and I wanted to go to treatment because, well, I needed to go to treatment. I don't know that I wanted to be there. But I knew that I was on a path of self-destruction and that if I didn't go, I was going to spend the rest of my life destroying myself. I arrived at my first treatment center and I walked into the ward and the door shut and locked behind me. And there was a woman pacing up and down the hallway, going up and down and up and down and saying numbers to herself and words, apple, 80, yogurt, 140. And I was like, what is she doing? Well, it turns out she was counting calories, like tallying what she had eaten. There was another girl in the hallway on a feeding tube that terrified me. Never seen anyone on a feeding tube before. And that was my first treatment center. My name is Daralise Lyons, and I'm a journalist by trade. And I've been in a jagged upward line of eating disorder recovery for at least the last 14 years, maybe a little longer. That first locked ward was a center where people were really, really ill, much sicker than any of the places I'd go to subsequently. You couldn't go to the bathroom alone or hang out in your room, so everyone lived in this one hallway during the day. That first experience was dehumanizing. I stayed for, I think, 4 weeks or so, left, relapsed, and found another treatment center. Frankly, the old me used to love institutions. I wished I could spend the rest of my life in one. It almost felt like being bubble wrapped. It was so painful to be in the disease that by the time I went into a treatment facility, I was like, oh, thank God, a break from myself. I grew up in Connecticut, but as a result of frequenting all these different treatment centers, I've lived at various places in the country. I went into treatment first once, and then twice, and then 3 times, and then 10 times, and every time it would work for a while, but then I'd relapse. I'd come out, and I'd be sort of manic. One time I stole food on the way out the door of a treatment center and was binging and purging by the time I got home. They always tell you not to make any major changes in the first year of recovery, but I'd come out, and I'd quit my job, or end a relationship, or fixate on finding the man or woman of my dreams, or buy a house. I did that twice. I remember everything being very magnified and intense, but it felt real. So one day in my mid-20s, I went to New York City to see a soul astrologer. I was pretty desperate and I didn't know if it would help me, but I knew that I needed to seek some sort of different solution. The only information that I gave her was the date, time, and location of my birth. And I have no idea what she did. She had a computer program and she typed in some things. Maybe I was just in a vulnerable place. But in that moment, on that day, I thought, yes, I'm going to turn my life over to this woman because I'm a complete mess. And actually, I felt like I could have turned my life over to a doorknob and it would have done a better job of navigating than me. And then she looked at me and she said, why are you working in finance? That's the wrong job for you. And if you don't give up your eating disorder, you're going to die. And I was like, what? At the time, I was a fairly normal body size. And maybe she could have just looked at me and known, but I don't think so, because no one else had ever confronted me before. But then this woman, her name was Margot, she said, I think you're going to end up in Philly. Now, I'd already been to the Renfrew Center twice before, and I thought, I'm not going back there again. They're not going to help me. I've already been there. But I sat with her for a while, and she helped me find a treatment center in Chicago, which I ended up going to for a month. It was my 16th institutionalization. And then I was transferred from there to a center in Florida for a month, my 17th. I went back to Connecticut very, very briefly, but I needed the bubble wrap of an institution again. And it turned out that the Renfrew Center in Philadelphia was one of the only long-term transitional living programs in the country at that moment. I thought, oh God, Margot was right. I'm going to have to go back to Philly.
From WHYY, you're listening to Philadelphia Revealed. I'm your host, Jamie Jay, Executive Director of First Person Arts, a nonprofit organization that believes everyone has a story to tell. Across 10 episodes, you're going to get a tour of the Atwater Kent Collection, sometimes called Philadelphia's Attic. It's a collection that's grown over decades, acquiring Philly's material culture from individuals, families, institutions, sometimes literally from the trash. In every episode of this podcast, you'll learn about an object in the Atwater Kent collection and hear a story inspired by it from a first-person art storyteller. We think every Philadelphian will be able to see themselves in this collection, and that learning about Philadelphia's many histories can help us understand its present and future. This is episode 10, Publicly and Spectacularly Crazy, with storyteller Darylise Lyons. Darylise is a journalist, actor, and activist who is passionate about exposing the painful side of history and standing for a more integrated world. She was inspired by an oil painting in the collection. It's from 1865, and it's a portrait of a woman on a Philadelphia street, and it's titled Crazy Nora.
It's a picture of a woman standing on a brick sidewalk at a street corner in front of a hotel. She's sort of dressed in, I would say, androgynous clothing and wearing a top hat. I think if someone just came and looked at this, they wouldn't necessarily know the gender of the individual in the portrait. And I'm really curious about this painting because it's a depiction of a woman in Philadelphia, either in the midst of madness or post having some sort of mental health crisis or mental breakdown. And it reminds me actually a lot of myself. I moved to Philadelphia after being institutionalized for my 18th inpatient eating disorder treatment. The fact that this painting is referred to as Crazy Nora makes me think a lot about myself and how others might have perceived me from the outside and how I perceive myself. I guess it was sort of against my will that I came to Philly. Now I love it, but I didn't expect to come here or to stay here at all.
I've sort of fallen in love with this painting and gotten very granular as to exactly where she is standing in the city. I'm Jen Zarrow, and I've been studying this painting since about 1999.
It's a portrait of a tall woman standing next to a street lamp on the corner of Knife and Chestnut Streets, with a serious expression on her face, wearing a plaid cloak, black boots, and a black hat.
Those would have been her, you know, quote-unquote, man's hat and man's boots that she always wore. She's looking off into the distance. Her left hand is resting on a wooden crate. The streets are cobbled and paved. The gas lamp is in place. A beautiful hotel is in the background. Fashionable people are strolling the streets. And Nora is kind of just this iconic, tall, stately figure right there in the middle of the urban landscape.
Jen Zarrow is an art historian who teaches at the Tyler School of Art and Architecture at Temple University. And
my great-great-great-grandfather is William E. Winner, the painter. And often growing up, my grandmother would speak about the figure of Crazy Nora or the artist. So this painting kind of had its own lore in my own childhood.
William E. Winner was a professional artist in 19th century Philadelphia. He exhibited his work every year at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts and was very successful for his religious paintings and portraits. But there's one particular work that fascinates Jen as an art historian, and it all begins with stories her grandmother used to tell.
What she said and what most people said about Crazy Nora is often repeated, that she was a quote-unquote bag lady or a homeless person who roamed the streets of the city and who was sort of a crazy celebrity of the city. She certainly was very famous in her day, so everyone in the city would have known her. And I think the painting kind of captured her as this iconic figure, kind of just fascinated me for such a long time. Who is she? What is her story? Why did he paint her? Why was she famous? Why was she called crazy?
Darylise had questions too.
I'm less curious about the observer's perspective of Nora and more curious about Nora's perspective of herself. What her take on her own, like, quote-unquote, insanity was, and how happy she was with herself and with her life, and whether she had hopes or dreams that she achieved or didn't. Like, if she had a voice, what would she say? And how would she have wanted to be depicted? And I don't know that there will ever be an answer to that, but that's what I'm curious about.
Most of the accounts of Nora come through what was written about her after her death, but there are firsthand accounts of her life told by folks of the time. She was born sometime in 1788, 1790 in Limerick, Ireland. Her family was wealthy, but her parents died when she was quite young.
She wasn't always known as Crazy Nora. Her given name was Honora Power. Nora's parents left her and her sister an annual sum that should have kept them comfortable, even as orphans. Nora went to live with her sister, but her sister's husband stole the money.
The family, Nora, her sister, and this husband, are put out into the street. Their home is taken, their money is gone. So she experiences this real, like, perfidy by this family member, this man, who harms them in this way, and it's one of these early tragedies of her life. After that, she comes to Philadelphia.
Nora arrived in Philadelphia around 1820, when she was in her 20s or early 30s, an Irish immigrant before the potato famine wave.
She's young, and she's alone. She is industrious, she's hardworking, she's Catholic, she's pious, she is reliable, and she's known for these things. She is a boarder, works as a nanny, maybe a housekeeper.
She finds a job working at a boarding school.
She is happy to work at an all-girls school run by a woman after experiencing this upheaval by her brother-in-law, this man in her life. At the same time, in Philadelphia, there was a new Catholic priest at St. Mary's Church by the name of William Hogan. And he is a bit of a charlatan. This is his actions in the Catholic history of Philadelphia lead to a great schism in the Catholic Church. But Nora is kind of under his spell.
This is early in the history of the Catholic Church in America. The Vatican was far, and local trustees of each church, lay people in the congregation, held more sway than they do now. At Nora's church, St. Mary's, there was a new priest, William Hogan, who the trustees and the congregants really liked. He was charismatic, a great talker, very social, maybe too social. He was known for taking an interest in church ladies who loved him. Articles of the time describe Hogan as superficial and shallow. Nora supported him, but the bishop disapproved of Hogan. He tried to rein him in and ultimately excommunicated him. This led to a full-blown schism in the church, one that Nora was deeply impacted by and may have even witnessed or participated in.
So there's a big riot and a big fight, a very bloody fight from the accounts and the reports. Actual street riot, bats, bricks. The church is kind of desecrated in this riot. People are fighting. Reports sort of point to this as another really major moment in Nora's life that lead to some kind of break, you know, some kind of real uncertainty and stress that lead her to the next day going to the roof of where she was living and start throwing bricks and stones and pebbles down and talking about saints and the devil. So most accounts point to that moment as the break that she experiences that really leads to her becoming called Crazy Nora.
If you're wondering about those accounts of Nora, why we know so much about this one particular Irish immigrant from the early 1800s, it's because from this moment on, there's a striking amount of documentation of Nora and her life. There are newspaper articles, poems, and this painting.
She begins to become a well-known street character, as they were known at the time. We know that Nora moved around the city pretty much day by day. She was known to always have a very large bag or box with her, full of her books, her salves, her trinkets. She was also known for trying to teach kids to pray the Lord's Prayer and the Catholic Creed. And if they did, they would get a little bauble from the bags or boxes she would carry around with her every day. She also had a little lending library in her bag. She would find books on the lives of the saints or you know, romance novels of the day and things like that. And she would lend the books out to people for money. I found in my research a bank account that Nora held. So she always had a place to live. She had a bank account and she had friends and she would interact with people. You know, some of these interactions made her become very famous.
One recorded incident, Nora walked into a Quaker meeting house and sat not on the women's side, but on the men's.
There's so much about Nora that is pushing against the norms, expectations, and scripts and codes of the day. You know, a woman who was not wearing gendered clothing. In the 19th century, that alone, right, would have had you been called crazy.
Nora also became infamous for one of her many jobs as a debt collector.
She was, to use the 19th century word, a dun.
A dun gets people to pay their debts one way or another.
Stories say that she was put on the hardest cases, and she was very successful. One of her strategies for getting these debts repaid was to hover around the person's house or their place of business or wherever they were in the city and to kind of air their dirty laundry, right? To say like, well, I saw you walking with so-and-so, or to begin one of her religious stories, stories about the devil and how the devil was going to show up at your doorstep. She would call on people's deceased grandmothers or her own deceased grandmother. And eventually she would wear these folks down where they would repay the debt in full. There are also reports that she would have to defend herself on the streets. There are stories of boys taunting her, physically abusing her, often while grown men looked on, urging on this kind of play. And so we also have reports that she could throw a brick for two blocks.
All of this turned Nora into something of a celebrity, and not just in Philadelphia.
One very interesting one comes from an early travel writing about traveling in London. The writer is in a park and says, oh, the women are wearing hats, just like Crazy Nora of Philadelphia. Papers in other cities are writing about who is the new Crazy Nora of our town. And so there's reference to her continually for some period.
Jen still doesn't know why her great-great-great-grandfather, William E. Winner, chose to paint Nora in particular. He was known for genre paintings, a style popular in his day, portraits of everyday people in everyday street scenes, like the pie man or the street urchin. In Winner's painting, Nora looks strong, tough. But what would Nora have thought of it? Or any of the accounts about her? Jen Zero says in all her research, she hasn't found anything written in Nora's own words.
We don't have a record of her saying, I am, or I want, or this happened to me, and this is how I feel about it. But I think we do have a record of somebody who unabashedly shaped herself and her life creatively, even within the stressors and limitations and codes and classism and anti-immigration and nativist sentiment at the time. She had so much pushing against her, and she had so many stressors, and not just personal, but vastly social, national. And still she has this determined integrity that she sticks to throughout her life.
Nora died in a home at 16th and Lombard, which we know from an account published in the Catholic Chronicles. She was feeling ill and knocked at the home of a family she knew. Nora had pneumonia. The family called a priest to give her last rites.
This is a person who had cared about people and who had people who cared about her to her dying moments.
I think that Nora was a person with a whole lot of dimensions. It seems like there might have been some different communities that had different reactions to Nora, because she was like a bill collector, right? And so I would imagine that there were those who feared her and there were those who idolized her, and just sort of she wore a lot of hats, pun intended. I think Nora, in many ways, was a product of her times, but I also think we could, you know, give her a different hat and a different outfit, and, you know, she could fit in right here in Philadelphia in the year 2024. In the painting, Nora is standing in front of a hotel. And back when I was released from my 17th hospitalization in Florida and decided to give Renfrew another go, I drove all the way to Philadelphia, and I was supposed to transfer to Renfrew right away. But when I got there, they said, oh, we don't have a bed for you, and your insurance won't approve you, even though you were pre-approved before you came. So I left, but I'd already left my family's home in Connecticut, and not under the best of terms, because they were pretty sick of me being sick. And so I went and I checked myself into a nearby hotel, and I spent the next 3 days binging and purging in that hotel room. And after a few days, the Renfrew Center called me and they said, oh, you know, we do have a bed. Can you come tomorrow? And I said, no, tomorrow's my mom's birthday and I'm back in Connecticut. I lied. I was right there in Philly destroying myself, probably 2 miles away. But they said, if you don't come tomorrow, you can't come at all. And so the next day I did go and I checked myself in. And I felt shaky and like, what am I doing? And I shouldn't even be here. And I felt very ambivalent about recovery. I always feel ambivalent about my recovery in the midst of a relapse. But a woman came up to me and she asked, what are you in for? She asked me my name. And I thought, who is this person? Why are they trying to be friendly with me? When I'm not in a great place, I always think everyone is out to get me. And I always think people are horrible. I think no one is kind or loving or gentle or generous. And I assume the worst of people, which goes back to Crazy Nora, right? There was such a violence in her that I've had in the past in myself when I've not been in a good place. But there I was in this treatment center, my last one, hopefully. I told this woman my name, and then we talked about exercise. We probably had the most dysfunctional, most eating disordered conversation that there ever was. But we became friends. She broke my shell. I was there for about 3 months, and I still ended up relapsing not too long after I left and calling my mom and saying, I think I need to go back to treatment. And she was like, what are they going to do? You've been in treatment 18 times. You've spent 9 months out of the last year in various treatment centers, and you're going to have to figure out how to be in the world. And she was right. Somehow, I don't know, crawled my way out of that relapse and got into recovery in a real way. So here I was in Philly, thinking I'd only stay for a year, but that I needed to develop roots. So I got an apartment and a job. And I don't know, Philly took a hold of me. I started to make some friends, including my friend from the treatment center. I got to know my neighbors. I don't know, it was like some of my hardness melted away a bit, and I felt like I could be myself here. I didn't know it yet, but that would be the last time I ever went into treatment for my eating disorder. I mean, I want to knock wood and say that it's the last. I don't want to say I did figure it out. I think I just found really good supports and I managed to, I don't know, hit a reset button. I think that Nora was publicly and spectacularly crazy, but then again, we're all crazy in some ways. Or maybe I should say that we all have a relationship with mental health that can be activated or not activated depending on some external circumstances or life circumstances. But one of the things that I most valued about Nora was how much value she gave back to her community. And I like to think that that's also true of myself, that somehow my own struggles have made me more willing to engage and to fight hard for the things and the people that I believe in. And I don't know, I admire Nora. And if she were alive today, I would like to know her.
Selections from the Atwater Kent Collection are on view at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts from July 18 to December 1, 2024. And that's just one way to explore the collection. Coming soon, small exhibits will be traveling to public community venues like libraries and schools. And there are regular additions to the online collection at philadelphiahistory.org. Drexel plans to carefully add to the collection, mindful that history is made every day and significant portions of the past have yet to be included. The collection welcomes members of the public to help determine what's missing. Philadelphia history is still being told, and everyone has a story to tell. Philadelphia Revealed aims to find out what these objects mean to all of us and how they add up to our collective history. So come, share your own story with us. We'll be right back. Philadelphia Revealed podcast is a production of WHYY in partnership with Row Home Productions and First Person Arts. Our executive producers are Tom Grassler, Alex Lewis, John Myers, and me, Jamie J. Brunson. This episode of Philadelphia Revealed was written and produced by Jen Kinney. Our lead producer is Jen Kinney. Final mixing and mastering by John Myers and Justin Berger. Story editing from Padmini Raghunath. Our engineers are Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Charlie Kyer. Special thanks to the Atwater Kent Collection at Drexel University curatorial team. Paige Talbot, Stacy Swigart, Melissa Klemmer, and Michael Shepard. Special thanks also to Dr. Neil Bardhan, Jean Burke Spraker, and Michaela Prell at First Person Arts. Thank you to Michaela Winberg, Hannah Cornish, and Savannah Collins. Our theme music is by Paul Geis and Matt Jernigan. Thanks to Ms. Kramer and the Frankfurt High School Drumline. Additional music by Paul Geis and Blue Dot Sessions. Philadelphia Revealed is a project of Drexel University in collaboration with WHYY and First Person Arts. The Philadelphia Revealed podcast and additional programming has been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. I'm Jamie J. Thanks for listening. Philadelphia Revealed is part of the NPR Podcast Network.